and welcome to Conversations with the Academy, a podcast from the University of Arkansas School of Law. My name is Dorinda Sharp.
And I'm Colin Hesse. On this episode, Dorinda talks with Deborah Jones Merritt, the John Deaver Drinko Baker and Hostetler Chair in Law at Ohio State University. Merritt was on campus as part of the Hartman Hotz Lectures in Law and Liberal Arts and to discuss her research on cognitive science and the law.
We hope you enjoy the conversation.
You have been here to talk about cognition and justice.
That's right.
What got you interested in that field?
I have always wondered how people think and how they learn. I always wanted to be a teacher, and I consider myself primarily a teacher as a law professor. But in addition to doing it, I'm just captivated by how our brains work and how it is that we can learn as much as we do and how we can learn to learn even more.
And that led you down the path of how our learning affects how we litigate?
How our learning affects everything we do as lawyers. I read a lot in cognitive science literature, and I taught a course for a while on law and psychology in which I talked about a whole range of areas in which knowing about psychology can help us be better lawyers. After I started teaching in our law school clinic, which was a great learning experience in itself, I didn't have time to teach the law and psychology course, but I've kept up my interest in that field. So what I talked about yesterday was the ways in which lawyers have to think in order to serve clients in any context, because what we teach in law school is mostly the skills that are related to changing the law. How does one argue for a new interpretation of the law in an appellate court? Mm-hmm. Or how does one lobby for a new bill in the legislature? Mm-hmm. We think learning those skills are essential to being a good lawyer, but there's more to being a good lawyer than just those skills, especially when you're working with individual clients, whether it's an individual person or an individual organization or business. Mm-hmm. They have goals that will change and that will affect what you're going to do in the representation. The facts of their cases shift and change a lot. Mm-hmm. The rules that you work within are not just the legal rules, but also the unwritten rules of the courthouse or the negotiating room that you're in. Mm-hmm. So a lawyer has to have a very nimble and adaptive type of mentality in order to juggle all of these pieces. And that's something that doesn't come easily to the human brain.
Sure, yeah.
One of the basic points that cognitive scientists make about the brain is that we can think only about 4 to 7 things at one time. And the thing, which they call a bit of information, could be something very simple like a digit. If I asked you to remember a 7-digit phone number, you probably could do it. You would have to keep rehearsing it in your mind, but you could do it. If I give you a 10-digit phone number with the area code, you're going to have a hard time remembering that unless you write it down, because your brain doesn't have space for 10 different unrelated things. Mm-hmm. So it becomes very complicated then in legal representation to think, how does somebody take into account at one time in developing strategy all of these different facts and legal rules and client preferences and so forth? Because the brain just can't juggle that many things at once. The main way that we do it is by developing patterns. Okay. We learn as lawyers, if I'm working, for example, I supervise a clinic in criminal prosecution and one in defense, you learn certain patterns. One misdemeanor that we prosecute and defend involves prostitution, soliciting sex for money. As you look at a soliciting case, you begin sorting it into patterns. If the accused prostitute is a streetwalker, it's a different kind of case than if she advertised on Craigslist.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Different legal issues arise. The facts are different. The case will be affected by whether or not the accused prostitute is addicted to drugs. That will affect the kind of remedies she could get in the court, even though it's not a legal point. It's a factual point. So we develop patterns. And after you've had experience with a number of cases in one area, then you can more easily handle a new case in that area because you can use some of your existing patterns.
And that's part of why people develop specialties over time, I assume.
It's why they develop specialties over time and why working with new cases is important. And working with you want to work in a particular area, but also to have a diversity of cases in that area. If every case you do is the same type of streetwalker case. Mm-hmm. You will develop almost a mechanical way of handling those cases. In fact, you might not be the greatest lawyer because you'll just turn out the same thing for every case.
Right.
If you handle, as most lawyers do, a variety of misdemeanor crimes, then you will develop patterns for prostitution, patterns for shoplifting, patterns for domestic violence, and those inform one another. Sure. As well, and keep you a better lawyer. You might see something in a domestic violence case that's different, and you'll recognize that difference. On the other hand, if you tried at the same time you're doing criminal representation, write wills and do contracts and do employment discrimination, you may not be able to handle that much all at once.
Too much disparate information.
That's right. If you think about going to the doctor, some of the mental patterns are similar. They have different content, but it's the same sort of process. The doctor needs to diagnose what's wrong with you and then also needs to think about the best treatment in your particular case. And the doctor relies on patterns to do both of those things. Some doctors, like an internist, can do a certain set of patterns and a very broad set, including that she will know this sore throat might be throat cancer, whereas most of these sore throats are not. Mm-hmm. But then she doesn't have the specialized patterns for throat cancer that the specialist would have.
So you've been here as part of the Hartman Hotz lecture series in Law and Liberal Art.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a question and answer session after. Was there anything that was brought up in the Q&A that has made you maybe think differently about what you're working on or something you want to pursue now that or already wanted to but now you know other people are interested too?
There were a few things that were brought up, actually. One arose during the lunch, informal lunch that I had with faculty. I was talking a little bit about what I would speak on that afternoon and mentioned a particular type of interviewing, the cognitive interview that psychologists have developed and that is particularly applicable to many types of lawyers' work. One of the faculty members does real estate transactions, and in my conversation with him, I realized that the cognitive interview really doesn't apply to transactional interviews. It's useful when you're trying to get somebody to remember the facts of something that happened.
Oh, yeah.
So it's very useful in both civil and criminal litigation. It could be useful in real estate if you're trying to get somebody to remember when they bought the house or what certain conditions were. But there's a different style of interviewing that would be used there. So I actually quickly made some adjustments in my notes for the lecture.
Oh, that's nice.
To talk about. And then another question that came up was about the ways in which we do or don't teach students rule-abiding justice. I made a distinction in my lecture between what we do so much of in law school, which is teaching people how they can advocate for changes in the law, and what most clients need, which is help me get the best resolution within the law as it exists. And somebody asked me, well, don't we really do that application piece, the as applied piece in law school when we ask students to respond to new hypotheticals? How would you apply the rule from this case we've just read to a new client who said this? Or how would you, we often ask questions like that on exams. And that was something I had thought about before but didn't talk quite as much about in the main lecture. So I was glad to be able to expand a little bit. We do certainly teach students in law school how to apply the law to the new facts. The difference is that when clients come to us, it's not just a question of here's the law and here are my facts. We first have to figure out what those facts are, and the facts are very elusive. Right. They tend to change. And the client's goals change, too. It's a question of what's the best result I can get for this person who has particular preferences.
Okay.
We have actually had clients in our defense clinic who prefer to go to jail than to be on probation.
Oh.
So there's a different, and if you have a client who is an alcoholic or addicted, even if the crime has nothing to do directly with alcoholism, it makes a big difference if that person is willing to give up their addiction and to go into a rehab program. If they are, you'll get a much better deal from the prosecutor. So I think that in law school, we sometimes think that we're teaching the full range of skills that students need to interact with clients, but we're really teaching a very narrow subset of that. It's an essential subset. I would never disband what we do in law school. I think simply we need to rebalance it and integrate some other elements there. There was also a question that related to the issue of storytelling. which was something I hadn't touched upon in my talk, but is an important part of the way that we think and we communicate. Mm-hmm. Our brains do remember stories much easier, much more easily than we remember other things. So this is parallel to what I was talking about in the lecture. We can help students understand material in courses better if we can weave a story for them.
Sure.
If we can tell a story, if you can tell a story across the whole course, that's ideal. In my evidence course, which seems to be a lot of very disparate rules that are hard to learn each one, and then how do you put them together, I tell my students to think about the following story, that the rules of evidence are trying to exclude things that we really want to consider. And we're trying to do it because we think people would place too much weight on this consideration. Mm-hmm. One of the big things that we exclude is any evidence of prior convictions of the defendant. And we exclude that because it seems very relevant to us. We would like to. So it's an odd sort of negative story, but I think it helps students knit together the course, which otherwise is very difficult to tell a story about. Then we can also tell stories on a much smaller scale. For every client that we represent, there's a story, ultimately,
right,
that we would tell either in negotiation or at trial or even in a deal making. When I'm arguing with you about which one of us should get a greater share of the profits, I'm going to be telling a story about why my client is contributing more than your client is.
Sure.
And you'll have a different story. The way in which I differed from the person who asked the question about that was that I think the stories are not self-evident from the beginning, or at least they change significantly. And in fact, we have to guard against taking the first story that comes in the door.
Kind of like what you were talking about with goals changing and facts changing.
That's right. Okay. That when a client first comes and tells me their story, I may buy that story entirely. Mm-hmm. And yet it just may not hold up. Mm-hmm. It often doesn't hold up. People don't always lie consciously, but we each see the world from our own perspective,
right,
and we unconsciously color the facts to favor us. So that when I start getting other facts, the story is going to have to change. So part of being a good lawyer is also dealing with this change in stories. In fact, students who have talked to me about the difference between law school classes and what they see in clinics or externships often stress that element of change. They say, the difference, even in a simulation in law school, it's usually set from the beginning. You have particular goals and particular facts, and you can begin to tell a story.
Mm-hmm.
And your story may expand a little bit as you develop some additional facts, but it doesn't change. What's different about law practice is that the story keeps changing.
Oh, yeah.
And it can be very difficult to know the right time to solidify your story. If you're taking a case to trial, you can't make up your mind about the story the night before opening statements. But then again, you can't make up your mind about the story in the first client interview because the story just may not fit the facts.
Before you started practicing, you had some experience with some high-profile folks who might not have been high-profile at the time but are now. So you've worked with Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg and former Justice Sandra Day O'Connor. Could you tell us a little bit about those experiences?
Certainly. I actually heard first the name of Ruth Bader Ginsburg when I was a college student because my father was on the Columbia Law faculty and he was her new colleague. And I heard about this new phenomenon, a woman who had been appointed as a law professor, which seemed very new and exciting. And then when I was in law school, I had the great privilege of taking now Justice Ginsburg's constitutional law course. So I learned constitutional doctrine from her at the time when she was arguing cases before the Supreme Court about women's rights. And then I had been hired to clerk for a judge the year after I graduated from law school. I was offered the job the summer between my second and third years. And that judge tragically died at age 65 while playing tennis. He had a sudden heart attack. So there was a vacancy on the court, and it turned out that Professor Ginsburg was appointed as Judge Ginsburg. And so I was able to clerk for her during her very first year on the D.C. Circuit, which was
wow,
a very special opportunity. And then I was at the same kind of story evolved. I was hired by a justice named Potter Stewart to clerk for him on the Supreme Court. He resigned just a week before I would have started clerking for him, which is the way these resignations are usually made. The justice may decide early in the term and tells the president, but nobody else is able to know. So he hired clerks so that nobody would speculate about his possible retirement. But then this wonderful news that President Reagan was appointing Sandra Day O'Connor as his replacement. And I got a call in late July, you know, middle of the summer from her, saying that she would like me to be her clerk if she were confirmed by the Senate. So, again, I had this, you know, wonderful to clerk for a judge of any type, terrific to clerk on the Supreme Court, and to have clerked for Sandra Day O'Connor during her first term was remarkable.
That's wonderful. Have you kept up with any of this notorious RBG?
Oh, absolutely.
What are your thoughts?
It's amazing because Justice Ginsburg is a brilliant legal mind, and you don't really think of brilliant legal minds becoming cult figures. And she's also an extremely demure and well-dressed woman who, again, you don't think of this as something in the sort of rap mode. But I've read I not only have seen the website, but I've read the book that just kind of came out a few weeks ago by the authors of the website. And I think it's fabulous that people of all generations, I think, but especially the millennial generation, see as a real hero now this woman who might otherwise have been considered just a really cerebral, grandmotherly type. Yeah. And she has become a cult figure. And I think she loves it.
Oh, good.
I have heard that the T-shirts that people send her, she gives to her grandchildren.
Oh, that's nice.
And the cult figure status is also related to very important legal issues. Right. It started after her dissent in the Shelby County case, which was the case where the majority of the court really eviscerated the Voting Rights Act. And I think she quite properly, in dissent, called them to task for that. And then there were these people who said, "You go, Ruth." So I think that it's become a way, too, where people have always been interested in what the Supreme Court does, but people are continuing to take a real interest in what the court does.
It's interesting that they're still interested in what the court does, but now they're becoming more and more interested, it seems like, in what individual justices do. That I think more people know names of specific justices than in the past.
I think that's probably true. I mean, there's still all too many Americans who don't know the three branches of government, much less the names of the justices, which has, by the way, become the favorite project of Justice O'Connor in retirement. She has a project called iCivics, which is on a website with games, very well-designed games for middle school kids to play to learn about the Supreme Court and to learn about government and so forth.
That's brilliant.
It is brilliant. And she is there are many things that are her legacy, but I think this is the one that she cares the most about.
A part of your experience in legal practice is arguing in front of the Supreme Court.
Yes, yes.
Will you tell us about that experience?
Absolutely. I got this opportunity in 2009 because of Justice Ginsburg. There was a case that had come up from the Second Circuit where all of the parties disagreed with what the court below had done. In that circumstance, which happens sometimes once a year, occasionally years will go by without it happening, the court appoints a lawyer to represent the views of the lower court. So I was a friend of the court, an amicus, but most friends of the court just get to submit briefs. I actually did the argument for half of the argument because I represented the lower court. It was the only argument I had done since my first year of law school.
Oh, wow.
I had been a clerk, and I had seen many appellate arguments, and then I had participated in law school all these years as a judge on student moot courts and so forth, but I never argued a case in practice. So the last appellate argument I had done was in my first year of law school, 25 years earlier. Luckily, the opportunity came at a time when I had a lot of free time, in the sense that I was not committed to a scholarly project, didn't have a book deadline or something like that. So I made this my project for several months. My husband was a law school classmate and has since become a country bluegrass musician, but still has his legal license, and we like to talk law together. So he was my co-counsel on the brief. And our son, who is not a lawyer but knows all sorts of legal things, read the brief. He's a terrific editor. He worked with me on the brief as well. And then we all were in the courtroom. My husband was seated right next to me at counsel table because he's a member of the bar. Our son was in the other public benches watching. I think it was a case that was interesting to me, and I thought that I actually thought the side we were assigned was correct, even though I was assigned to it. And I also had an inkling we would probably lose because the court's jurisprudence went the other way. But it wasn't as if I was representing an issue that I felt very deeply about. I didn't have the fate of affirmative action in higher education resting on my shoulder. So I rehearsed a lot. I used students a lot to prepare for the argument. Students site checked the brief for me and did blue booking on it. And then I used several student panels for moot courts where they got to play the justices and I was arguing the case.
That must have been really interesting for those students.
I think so. And they were really good at it. I had some panels with faculty colleagues, but they frankly didn't take as much time to read the brief. The students did. So I thought the students asked really good questions. I printed out a color photo of each of the justices, a headshot. Mm-hmm. I was originally going to put them on my living room wall so that I would get familiar with them, but I decided not to actually tape them up. But I flipped through them periodically so I would feel comfortable when I was in the courtroom knowing who these people were.
Right.
And I found that the actual argument setting, it looks very magisterial from the back of the courtroom, but the way that the lectern is positioned, it's actually very intimate and supportive. You're right next to the bench, and sure, the justices are elevated a bit above you, but you really do feel that you can talk to them, and the rest of the courtroom sort of fades away behind you. Yeah. So I just had a great time doing it. I don't think I could do it again very often, if at all, because it took me a lot of time to prepare. I wanted to do it well.
Yes.
But it was a wonderful experience. Quite a number of students came to Washington. It happened that the argument was during our fall break,
we
no longer have the fall break, but we did that year. And so there were about a dozen students who came. And in fact, there were five of them who camped out from early in the morning so they'd be the first in line to get into the court.
Oh, that's great.
When the press came to interview them, they said, well, we're from Ohio State. We know how to tailgate.
A whole new thing, tailgating for the Supreme
Court.
That's
right. That's right. And I managed to work into my argument. One of the justices asked a question, and I said, to answer that, you could imagine a university library, such as, for example, Harvard University's library or the Ohio State University's library. My dean loved that.
I'm sure. You said it's not something you'd want to do again anytime soon, but if called upon, would you?
Oh, I would. And of course, I would do it if it were an issue that had great personal meaning to me, too. I would put other things aside. This was a wonderful opportunity just to do the experience of a Supreme Court argument. It was in an area, copyright law, that I don't usually work in.
So before you went to law school, you majored in history.
I did.
There is a lot of talk these days about the value of a liberal arts education and the difference between learning a skill versus, learning information or how to think. Do you think your background in history was helpful, essential, unnecessary? In what way did it affect not only your time in law school, but what you've done since?
I think we need to discard that false category or the false dichotomy between skill and learning to think, because learning to think is a skill. Mm-hmm. And you make exactly the same dichotomy in your question that people, critics of higher education make and that many of us within higher education make. Thinking is a skill, and many of the things that we think of as physical skills involve a lot of thinking.
True.
I watch football games, and I'm amazed, the more I learn about football, how complicated it is. That those players aren't out there just throwing their weight around, literally, mm-hmm. and winning because they're faster or they're stronger than the other side. There are these complicated plays, and they've learned plays, and they've learned patterns. They've learned patterns just like the patterns we use as lawyers. So the question is really, how do we teach people how to think, mm-hmm. and to think in ways that will benefit them in their jobs, in their families, in their role as citizens? And when to answer that question, I think we also have to begin to distinguish between the means we use to teach and the subject matter. We often get confused when we think of liberal arts as something that has to happen in a classroom with a professor at the front and students in the benches. You can learn to think. In fact, you probably learn to think much better if you're engaged actively in some sort of experiential learning. You certainly also learn to think by reading and by being critical of what you read. But we mix up all these notions. Sometimes we attack liberal arts as being bad learning because it's in a classroom.
Right.
And I think there's something to that attack, that we can learn some things in a classroom, but we can learn other things when we're in a more small group discussion setting, or we're actually working on solving a problem together. But those things are very supportive of liberal arts thinking. They're just being offered in a different form.
Yeah.
There's also the big distinction between the liberal arts and professions is that the thinking we learn in professions translates directly to a particular job that we're going to do. The style of teaching and discussion in law school is very much a liberal arts style. We're not teaching people mechanical rules. We're not teaching them how to the most recent thing is welding against the liberal arts, right? Welding actually requires a lot of thought.
Right.
So this again gets to the false dichotomy. So we have a very liberal arts style, but the particular thinking people will also be able to apply directly to law. The thinking that I learned as a historian, I can apply to law, I can apply to business, I could apply it to medicine if I'd gone into medicine. So I hope that we'll start thinking more creatively about what it means to think and how we learn to think.
A lot of your research dovetails right into that.
Exactly. I've also been working on an idea that I originally thought would be great to give as this lecture, although in the end it wasn't as well worked out as what I presented yesterday, about law as a liberal art that tries to draw together what do we mean by law. People in law worry that law will become a trade school rather than a professional school.
Yeah.
I don't think that's likely to happen anytime soon. As I tried to show yesterday, even when one is doing the most routine, mundane case, this involves a lot of complex thought.
Right.
Anything we do to prepare somebody to do that thought has got to be good thinking.
And some of the things you've said publicly while you're here, you mentioned that you've always wanted to be a teacher. And you knew that even when you were in law school?
I knew that even when I was in nursery school.
Oh, right.
I have always wanted to be a teacher. From long enough ago that I'm not sure where it came from, but I was the oldest sister with younger sister and one younger brother. I would sometimes lasso them and make them sit as pupils while I instructed them. When they weren't willing to do that, I would gather my dolls and make them be my students.
Nice.
At one point, I loved the idea of, this is me as a future associate dean as well as teacher, I created an imaginary boarding school for my dolls, and I developed a schedule for them where, you know, what hour they would take social studies, what hour they would take English. And then as I went through school, I kept changing the level at which I wanted to teach. When I was in second grade, I wanted to be a second grade teacher and so forth and so on. When I was in college, I initially thought that I would do a PhD in history and become a history professor. But during my parents had been working on me to go to law school. My father is a law professor. I could go to his law school free. That was a great attraction. And my mother, who had only graduated from high school, had never, as a woman in her generation, even considered going to college, was very committed to her daughters having as my father was too, but very professional careers, and that we could do this and we should do this.
Nice.
And by my senior year of college, I still liked the idea of being a history professor, but it didn't quite have the real-world impact that I wanted to have. I loved thinking about ideas and talking with students about them, but law really seemed to offer that plus the chance to have an impact on the world. So I decided to take up the offer of free law school and see what I thought of it. And I fell in love with law school after a few weeks and then switched my dream to becoming a law professor, although didn't know how that would work out because you usually don't go directly to being a law professor. But after I had clerked and then practiced for 2 years, I did go into law teaching, and it's been just what I always wanted to do.
Oh, good. When you were practicing, what did you
do? I worked for a small firm in Atlanta, Georgia. I married one of my law school classmates, and he was particularly interested in practicing in Atlanta. I didn't have any strong preference about a city, and it seemed like a good place to start a legal career. So we both went to small firms in that town. I did litigation with a partner. The firm that I worked for at that time was actually arguing a case before the Supreme Court, a case that involved whether or not Title VII applies to partnerships. There was another law firm in Atlanta that had denied a woman partnership, and no other lawyer in Atlanta would take her case against King & Spalding, the big firm in town. But my firm, the senior partner, took her case. I wasn't allowed to work on the case because you're disqualified for 2 years after you're a clerk from working on a case before the Supreme Court, but I knew it was going on in the firm. I was working on a very interesting case, a huge class action involving Coca-Cola bottlers against the Coca-Cola company. And it actually involved the interpretation of a contract that was executed in 1918 or something like that. It was a perpetual contract to bottle Coca-Cola syrup. And we were interpreting, it was a very basic contract case in some ways and a case about the specialness of Coca-Cola. We at one point actually got an order from the district court that the Coca-Cola company would disclose to us the secret formula.
Oh, my goodness.
But, of course, they chose not to do that. They instead had to concede an issue in the case. And there was one. I had a very short practice experience, but I did have the opportunity to depose a senior vice president from Coca-Cola. And everybody else, when we had deposed them, deposition is when you ask questions before a civil trial to get a sense of what the witnesses will say. We asked every witness, do you know the secret formula? And all of them said no. When I asked this witness, do you know the secret formula, he said, I refuse to answer that grounds under trade secret privilege.
Okay.
So, of course, we knew then that he did know
it. Of course,
because
yes.
Otherwise he would have just said no.
And so you went from that into teaching.
Mm-hmm.
Your first teaching job was where?
At the University of Illinois in Champaign-Urbana. Okay. I taught there for 11 years. And then Ohio State offered me a very special opportunity. And Ohio was always a home of a sort to me. I wasn't born in Ohio and I didn't grow up there, but my parents had lived in Ohio for a couple of years before I was born. And they always talked about how much they loved Cleveland and they wished that they'd been able to stay there. And my husband, who I met in law school, had grown up in Ohio and his family was still there. So we have become true blue Buckeyes. What a terrible phrase, because it's Michigan that's true blue. We have become fully scarlet and gray Buckeyes.
There you go. Well, we appreciate Ohio State for sharing you with us
for
a few days.
Well, I'm delighted to be here.
Thanks.
Music for Conversations with the Academy was written and performed by Josh Woodward. For more information and additional podcasts, go to kuaf.com or law.uark.edu. You can also listen to episodes or subscribe to our podcast through iTunes, on Stitcher, or with your favorite podcast app. Follow the University of Arkansas School of Law on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter by searching for UARK Law. That's UARKLAW. Thank you for listening.